This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
There's two pieces of learning that I want to do before we get into the discussion. The first is from a work called Avos to Rabbi Nosson. You're all familiar, I'm sure, with Pirkei Avos, the Ethics of the Fathers. Well, Rabbi Nathan wrote his own version of Pirkei Avos at about the same time, so this was maybe 2,000 years ago. And his is an expanded version, so it covers the same ideas, but he expands it a great deal more than in the Ethics of the Fathers that we've got. And among the things there, and it's a work that isn't known that much, and everybody knows about it, but not everybody who's studied it and knows it. So among the things that he says is the following. And he says this on the phrase in Pirkei Avos of Asu Siag LaTorah, make a fence around the Torah. So in addition to what the Torah states, we have to make fences. And the idea of a fence around the mitzvah is twofold. The reason that you put up a fence is to stop people encroaching on your territory. But what's important to appreciate with a fence is you don't put the fence out on the sidewalk. You put the fence at the edge of your property. You put the fence where your property really ends. So where the rabbis institute a law to protect the Torah law, they're not pushing the law further up. They're demarcating the actual point at which it really stops. So for example, the Torah says don't write on Shabbat. The rabbis say don't move a pen on Shabbat. The essential law is don't write. The rabbis, in saying don't move a pen, are defining where that law really stops, where the outer edge of that law is. If the Torah doesn't want us to write, then it doesn't want us to handle pens and pencils. That's what the rabbis are saying. The rabbis are not saying the Torah says don't write, and we say, you know what, don't even handle pencils. That's not how a Drabbanan works. The Drabbanan is the law of the rabbis is an analysis of if this is the essence, where's the fence? What is the outer limit of that law? And that's the principle of a siag, of rabbinic decrees that go beyond the essential statements of the Torah itself. Now, the first rabbinic decree was instituted by who? He was the first rabbi, Adam was the first rabbinic decree, and he decreed it on his wife. Sorry? Don't touch the tree when God said don't eat from the tree. Okay? It's a perfectly good rabbinic decree. God says don't eat from the tree. So Adam says, knowing human nature and knowing the law, it makes sense to say that the law really is don't handle the tree, don't get too close. Because you know people, you're busy, you're eating, you're climbing the tree, you're touching the tree, you're admiring the tree, there's this delicious fruit in the tree, you've just had an apple, you've just had a plum, and now you've got this Eitz HaDaas. It's unnatural not to indulge in it. So, again, the law of the rabbis is knowing the human nature. The Torah's laws are not for human nature. The Torah's laws are absolute. So the rabbis come to Rabbanan and say, knowing human nature and knowing the Torah's laws, this is where the fence ought to be. So Adam did it. There was only one problem with the way Adam did it. And what was that? Yes, he didn't make it clear that this was the law of the rabbi. He underestimated the intelligence of women. That was man's fatal flaw, and he did it once. And we've never stopped paying. All he had to say was, the Doraisa is, Hashem said, don't eat. I am saying. That means don't touch. If you want to discuss why I'm saying it, let's discuss that. But that's the law. The law now is don't touch. He didn't say that. He said, he didn't engage her in the discussion. The result of that was, the snake, that gave the snake his opportunity. He made her touch it. He pushed her against it. Said, look, nothing happened. So that brought into question the whole law and the degree of trust of Adam as the transmitter of that law. It broke down the whole chain of tradition. So as you know, Adam gets punished and she gets punished. Esther kalolos niskalala chava b'yisashah, says the Havos to Rabbi Nosson. She got 10 curses. Not one, she got 10. Did you know that?
No.
You thought it was only one.
He got one.
He got a few as well. He got three different views as to how many he got. He got quite a few. But you got 10.
And he thinks he got one.
got 10 together.
Yeah, but you got 10 little ones and he got one big one. Yeah, he got one, he got one tough one. Let's see what it is. So if you go through the 10, and it's 10 because if you take the verse, if you go through the verse, it's all in the verse, not making it up. What are the 10? The one is dam tzar nidov v'dam tzar betulim, that there is pain in menstruation and there is pain in a woman's first sexual relations. Shouldn't have been that way, but part of that pain is part of the 10. It's for next. The next one is the anguish of raising children.
Wow.
The pain of pregnancy, the discomfort of pregnancy. Okay, we know all about that. The post, what do they call it? The
postnatal depression.
They normally say that it's the pain of childbirth, but that isn't it. It's the etzev teldi bonim, that with sadness you give birth to children. And that's what the correct translation of that is. It shouldn't be that way. One should give birth to children with joy and happiness. And yes, there is joy and happiness, but there's also sadness, there's also depression.
Everybody's different, so why is that? I mean, not everybody gets depressed. Only
they're common.
They get less depressed or more depressed sometimes. And I notice that they're depressed. They're very fortunate in that. So that's very good. Sometimes they get depressed 10 years later. When it suddenly strikes them what they did 10 years ago. But it comes. Well, Ishech to Shukasech, and a woman will crave her husband. Melamed Sha Isha Mishta Kekes Abala Bishashi Yotzele. If a man goes off traveling and a woman wants him and desires his companionship and can't really do much about it, that's a kind of a dependency which is part of the curse, part of that punishment. For who Yim Sholbach, and that he masters you, rules over you, which means, says the Ovitz Rabbi Nasan, Sheha Ish Tavea Befeh Vaha Isha Tavas Belev. A man, when he wants a woman or he wants sexual relations, can make his desires clear without making himself less attractive. When a woman becomes too active in the pursuit, she actually loses some of her value. And that means it's hard for her. That's very frustrating. He wants a date on Saturday night, he picks up the phone and he phones somebody, and she says no, he picks up another phone and phones somebody, and she says no, he picks up a third phone and phones somebody. It's not the end of the world. She can't really do that easily. And that's very frustrating. So all she can do is to vast belief, to establish relationships, to be attractive, to do things like that. But it's much more of a passive way of interacting, which continues through marriage in a sense. And that's frustrating, and that puts her at a disadvantage. Atufo ke avel, she has to cover her hair like as if she's in mourning. One of the curses. The chavushah mikol odom bevei tzatzur. In the old days, you used to cover your hair in mourning. We don't do that anymore. A whole lot of things that we used to do in mourning, which we don't do anymore. But that was one of them. The chavushah mikol odom bevei tzatzurim, and she is imprisoned in her home. An interesting thing. She's imprisoned in her home. Umenudeh mikol odom, and she is excommunicated from all people. Like her social condition and the laws of tzniyus and staying at home all excommunicate her from society, detach her from society. Mi garam l'negiyazu, what caused that? The siag, etc. But with the incorrect imposition of a rabbinic law. Now, this is all very fascinating, but the particular side that I want to look at it is to look what are the things that are classified together here. How do we treat it? For example, when a woman comes to a rabbi and says, you know, this business of covering the hair, I'm having some difficulty with it. Esther, what did you say last week? What do they answer you?
To learn more about it.
And then what?
Understanding, and then you'll come to acknowledge the importance and the value and the halacha of it.
Right. Now, we don't take that approach. If a woman comes and says, I'm suffering from postnatal depression, we don't say, no, learn a bit more about it and you'll understand it and you'll start enjoying it. We don't say that. We say, I'm really sorry. It's normal, it's not unnatural, and I'm sorry you're going through this. And that's part of what it is, and it wasn't designed to be that way. That's part of our own choices. That's one of the consequences of what we did right at the beginning of time. Seems that Friday is a better day than Wednesday.
Really.
I used to give a Friday's ladies' shoe in Johannesburg.
Are you getting a reputation now
for this year?
Yeah.
You think so?
Yeah.
I used to do a Friday shoe in Johannesburg. The reason I chose Friday is I thought nobody would come because the women were pestering me. We want a women's shoe, we want a women's shoe, we want a women's shoe. So I said, Friday morning. You can't imagine how the women loved it. It was crowded out and we had went on for years. And they loved getting out of the kitchen on Friday and getting away. And they
Yes.
So the
it's another experiment we can try.
Oh. So we don't do that with postnatal depression. We don't do that with menstruation. We don't do that. These are things that God didn't intend to be there. They are the consequences of that episode, just like death is. We don't say, you know, learn about death and you'll come to quite like it. You'll see the beauty of it. We don't say that. We comfort people. Now, how do you think it would be? And again, let's get back into our real, the real honesty mode that we developed over the last few weeks. If when a woman was having trouble with the idea of covering her hair and she went to a rabbi, and the rabbi said, I really sympathize. I know it's tough. It's really, really hard. But you're part of a religious family and a religious community and you want to live a religious life. Of course, it's your choice as to what you do. It's really hard on a woman. It's really tough. This is where it's from. This is what it is. That's what it is. Is it beautiful and lovely and wonderful? No, it's more beautiful to wear your own hair. That's the truth. There's a shape of love. Yeah, but still, it's a nuisance. And I sympathize and I wish it weren't that way. And what can we do to let's figure out how to make it as easy as it can be? And as how would women find that as opposed to, you know, it's really very beautiful and you're maybe just not on the level, but when you are on the level, you understand how beautiful it is and learn more about it. What do you think women would respond better to? I'm really interested to know because I don't know the answer.
I've heard rabbis give the idealistic response to women. So they'll either give them, now I've had to be saying, you know, right now is not the right time for you of your hair. Either be married for what, you know, just that it's not for you.
That's not the truth that I'm saying. What I'm saying is, it's really a wonderful thing, and when you're on the level, you'll understand how wonderful it is. Or the other view to say, you know, it is a terrible thing that a woman has to do this. If I was a woman, I don't know if I could do that. And let's try and understand why and where it comes from and all the rest of it. But it's part of, let me put it to you this way. When a young man is learning in yeshiva, and he wants to go out to earn his living, what do they tell him? Why not? Yeah. You know, it's part of the curse of Adam. If you don't have to, why do it? Why get involved in the curse stuff? If you can sit and learn and you can manage, why get involved in the curse stuff? When a woman says, I don't want to wear the shaitel, what do they say? That's beautiful. Now, one second. Either we accept the curses and we work out how to work with them, or we resist the curses. But why, when it's men, do we say, that's work, it's a terrible thing, and religious people shouldn't have to do it, and let your wife work, and you should let her have your curse too.
That's
and
right.
You sit in yeshiva, what do you have to worry about? When the woman comes with her curse problems, we tell her it's beautiful. And if she'll learn a little bit more, she'll understand just how beautiful it is. Isn't there something wrong with the educational system if this is what it is? And I'm asking you, how would a woman react if we were honest with her and said it isn't beautiful?
I think she'd be in shock and she'd have to get over the shock of having been dealt with honestly.
Yeah. Let's say she's dealt with honestly from the beginning. Let's say the first time a woman deals with this. My daughter's asked me about it, and we discuss it. And we discuss the difficulty of it. And is it worth it? And where does it come from? I don't give them this, that it's beautiful and wonderful and fantastic. That's not why we do it. We don't do it because it's beautiful, wonderful, and fantastic. The fact is that mankind having deteriorated as it did at that time, there are a whole lot of things that we're now better off doing than not doing, but we would have been still better off if we never had to come onto it. Right? This is not like those mitzvahs that were in place in any case, that God wanted in any case. This is not one of the ideals. This is an outcome of sin. And it's there to prevent further deterioration. It's like taking a medicine. You don't say to a person who's taking medicine and put a person on chemotherapy and tell them, you know, if you learn more about it, you'll begin to enjoy it. You don't say that.
But
you say, you're in a state where if you don't do this, there'll be further deterioration. You have to do it. Now let's try and do it, make it as comfortable as possible. Let's try and help. Let's sympathize and understand. But you don't say this is the ideal. Mankind got ill at that time. Mankind developed a cancer at that moment when Adam dealt with it incorrectly, from which we've never recovered. And God now gave us various different things to help us cope with the consequence of that decision.
How do these things help?
Well, that we can discuss, but what I want to know is that first, how do they help cope? But all what I want to discuss firstly is, what would a woman's response be? The two roots. The one is creating the illusion that this is an ideal, and the other is saying, this is not an ideal, it shouldn't be this way, but it is this way. Let's try and figure out why it's this way, and then you decide whether you want to do it or you don't want to do it. But it's not that it's more beautiful in your own hair. It isn't more beautiful in your own hair.
You have to add the part about why we'll fall more. I mean, you have to give some... So it happened because they ate from the tree.
Okay, so I'll deal
so
with that.
So now you're stuck with, you know, having postpartum depression and stuff like that, but... I mean, you're not stuck with having to cover your hair. I mean, like postpartum depression. I mean, you're going to have a baby.
Yeah, this is a choice.
Okay, so this is a choice. So then there's got to be some...
But you know, it really isn't a choice, because if you consider, it's only in the last 50 years or so that it's become a choice. If you're living in a society where everybody does it, go to Iran and try not to cover your face and see what happens to you. You don't... In Jewish society, you couldn't not cover your hair until 50 or 60 years ago, 100 years ago. You couldn't. It was like walking up without clothes on. Your society wouldn't tolerate it. So it wasn't really something that a woman had a choice to do in those days. It's very new that a woman has a choice in this particular area. And why is it something that helps cope with it? It doesn't help an individual cope, and that's also one of the hardships. It helps society. And these are laws designed for society, not for individuals. And that's very hard for a woman too, because she says, but I'm not part of that. I'm not affected by it the same way. And that's a very difficult thing to deal with. What's the issue of society? The issue of society is that... in that episode of Adam the snake and Chava, woman's attractiveness and seductiveness was used as part of this whole. It wasn't just Adam. Adam was wrong in the way he taught the law. She was wrong in the way she engaged with the snake, which is the sensual part of herself, and the way she used that in engaging Adam in part of that sin as well. So what happened here was, this was the first time where we saw that the power of woman exceeds moral power, the power of God, the power of man, the power of intellect. That's really what that story is about, that sexuality is more powerful, that feminine sexuality is more powerful than any other force in the world. That's what that piece of Chumash teaches. And now if we teach our daughters and our young people that what we're dealing with in these laws is how a religious society copes with you, who has a power that you don't even know about, that is stronger than God. Not stronger than God in the absolute, but stronger than God's power in the world in interpersonal interaction. What do you do? How do you cope with that? How does, and again, it's not you as a woman and you as a man, because we can't take the legal system and start breaking it down into each individual and how they fit in. We're designing a system for society that has to live throughout the ages. So we're saying, well, one second, if that's what you're going to do, Chavo, if you don't know how to integrate, and that was the cancer, if you haven't been able to integrate, and until we get this right, and the story of society, by the way, is to try and get it right, to try and get back to the way we were before the sin. That's what we're struggling to do. There's that piece of the Derech Hashem. Did you ever learn Derech Hashem? Did my father learn Derech Hashem? Here we're in San Jose.
Here.
Remember, either those of you who did it right, the beginning of Derech Hashem. Near the beginning, I think he does that, where the purpose of civilization is to build itself back to where it was before the sin. We're not doing a good job of it. But that's what God really wants of us, is to try and get ourselves back to where... What are you upset about? We're not doing a good job of it?
Come on. Every day, every shir I've ever been to has emphasized the inexorability of Yerichat HaDorot. That all of our ancestors are so much better than we are, and we're just like, you know, ants on the shoulders of giants. And how could, now you're turning around and say, after all this time you're saying it is absolutely part of the nature of things. Your Rita Hazarot is inevitable. And now you're saying the whole purpose of our creation is to return?
to resist gravity, to resist the forces of gravity.
I'm sorry. But you have said, you and everyone before you and everyone after you has said, that it is an inevitable part of the nature of reality that that we are deteriorating.
Your question is not, I've got to disappoint you.
And now you're
as
telling
good
us,
a question
oh,
as
no.
it is.
Okay. Turn it around.
As good a question as it is.
Go back to the beginning.
As good a question as it is, I've got to disappoint you, it's not original.
I know it's not original, but
the
it's
question the question is a very important question, and a very good question, and has been asked by great rabbis, and one of the most successful answers, or one of the most satisfying answers is, no, is we have one advantage over there. Now listen to the answer. Liz, listen to the answer, because as clever as the question is, the answer is even cleverer. We have... It's true, each individual that we are smaller than the equivalent individuals who lived generations ago. However, we have one advantage that they don't have. We contain the experience of all that history. That means we could instantly reverse that. If we took our history and really learned the lesson from it, and looked at it squarely, and made some decisions, any generation could reverse that whole process. Because the one thing we've got that they didn't have is the advantage of their experience and knowledge, plus everything since then.
What you're saying
so we
is
have
if
something
we could only adequately learn from the mistakes of the previous 5,000 years, if we could like sum up all their mistakes at once.
Not just mistakes.
Totally get all of their mistakes, what worked and what didn't work about the last 5,000 years. If we could integrate all that, poof.
Not just, integrate the mistakes.
Day.
We genetically, we comprise of all of that. We are the accumulation of 5,000 years of history. They aren't. We have something that Abraham didn't have. He had a whole lot that we don't have. But we have something that he didn't have. We've got something that Moshe didn't have. We have something that the Rambam didn't have all the way through. We have the accumulation of these number of years which he didn't have. Now, we're not using that to proper advantage. We're using it in technology. And you can see in technology what man is capable of doing. If we apply the same efforts and energies that we put into technology and money, and we put that into Torah, believe me, we could get back to where we were very quickly. It's just that man has chosen to put its resources into technology. And that's only one decision that has to change. Mankind simply has to say, this is more important to us than technology for the meanwhile. Let's get this right first.
Let's
put all our resources in.
Backwards is forwards and forwards is backwards.
I'm saying individuals... Each individual is smaller than equivalent individuals in previous times from a moral and a civilization perspective. However, society has within it far more today than it ever had before. And
net
it is... Sorry?
Net.
Yes, total. Society contains today everything that existed before, plus ourselves. And the proof of it is what we've been able to do in technology. And the continuing rate, the speed at which things are moving. Each generation, we I don't know by what kind of power that the rate of progress improves. Because we focus so entirely on that area.
And what you're saying is that Yuri Dahedra is a choice and not a necessity.
Yes, so for society, it's a necessity.
As we have been told that it's an inevitable necessity.
Of individuals.
And what you're saying is that's not so.
It's a necessity for individuals. It's a choice of society.
But society is made
up. I cannot be the Vilna Gaon. I do not have
the
choice.
The net sum of all of the choices of individuals, if every woman covered her hair, although individually there would be a cost to every woman, the net result to society would be a plus. So you're saying that the net result of all the individual choices add up to a society. So either you say that or you don't say that.
Therefore?
Therefore, Yuri Dahedra wrote. You just said that Yuri Dahedra wrote is a necessity for the individual, but
let's
not
understand.
A necessity for the society.
Let's understand. What does Yuri Dahedra wrote mean? In what way are earlier generations better than I am? What do they have that I don't have? And those that were before Sinai?
They're further from Sinai, but they were getting closer.
very, very simple. They were better in one area only, and that is purity. Less distraction. That's why they were better. They had the world wasn't a better place. In some ways, the world is a better place today. There's more chesed in the world, there's less idolatry in the world. In many ways, the world is a better place today than it was then. We build hospitals, we build old age homes to take care of the elderly, we have charitable organizations. We have things that society didn't even have 200 years ago, never mind 1,000 years ago. So in some ways, we've evolved enormously. The only thing that they have that we don't have, it's like the difference between living in a small town and the kids that are raised there. They don't have all the opportunities of the kids in the big town, but they have a certain amount of purity, which is very attractive. That purity is something that they had that enabled them to grasp godly issues in a way that we find difficult. So on a one-to-one basis, that purity that they had was an advantage. But in terms of potency, of power to change, of ability to affect what society can do today, our grandparents couldn't dream of what we have the capacity to do today. How can we talk about Yerida Kadosh when you look around what's around us? And all I'm saying is that's the area we've chosen to put our energies into. But if you take the energy that we put into that area, and we would put that all into, we wouldn't recover the purity. It is just too evolved to have that purity. There's too much going on. There's too much distraction to have that purity. But we could overcome the inadequacy of the purity with the enormity of our ability to achieve, because of what we contain in terms of knowledge. So yes, there's Yerida Kadosh in one area, and there's evolution in another area. And the question is to take the power we gain from evolution and use that to more than compensate for what we've lost in purity. And mankind could do that. That would be the outcome. So, how did we get onto that? What led you to that question? What was our...
The ultimate purpose is to get back to where they were before the situation.
So what are we talking about here? That would mean getting us back into a situation where woman is able to use her powers only in a positive and constructive way, and thereby stimulate growth and progress rather than detract or distract from growth and progress in Avodah Hashem, in the service of God. But that being the case, that's where we are, where there is this dichotomy between sexuality and purity, where there is this dichotomy between the use of feminine power and the striving for purity. Once we're in that situation, the question is, how do we manage that power? How do we contain it? And all the laws of Tzniut are designed at containing the power.
And it's also not putting down
power. Well, there's no need for it to be. That there's no need.
But, I mean, you could say it's containing it, but you could also, I mean, it feels like...
Oppressing it. Yeah, and one has to be careful.
Man has to cope with it. Let's just suppress it. And I mean, why don't men just pull it together? I mean, why should we have to, like, bend down? And
why don't men wear blinders instead of women wear shades?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why
should
men wear blinders instead of women cover their heads?
Yeah, so why? The question is why? So the question is why?
It does feel like suppression.
No, you had said that.
Well, this is better than everybody saying it's beautiful and wonderful
what's
and lovely and great.
I don't think that's what you answered about no. The one question when you said, what did they feel like? Besides you, you said that you feel relieved about the honesty.
I'm in the process of still explaining it, because Karen said that in that case you've got to explain why, even though it's not an ideal, why it was instituted. So let's assuming now I'm explaining this to the young lady. But this is why it is, and society is in a situation where you as a young lady have powers that, if not contained, will destroy anybody striving for purity.
Thanks a lot. I mean,
that doesn't say how is that woman supposed to use those powers. You just say, cover it up so you can't really use it. Or
good
it's
point.
It's not like directing it so you know kind of what it is that you have.
So let's say we then studied with the same young women some of the very erotic passages of the Talmud that explain to women how to use those powers.
Which are never taught. Never mind.
But I'm trying to evolve with you a way that would work. So now right. I come along and I'm studying with my daughter or a young lady who now needs to know what this is all about, and I'm explaining what this power is, how it can be used and how it shouldn't be used, and how society needs to function in order to be able to operate in its midst. And therefore, explaining the difference between containment and suppression, because I think that's an important difference. There is a difference between containment and suppression. There is no desire to suppress it. There is a desire to contain it. And you're right. The way it's done today is suppression. The way it is today is suppressed, and that's why a lot of women resist it, and understandably so. It's not meant to be suppressed. All it's meant to be is contained.
Is it focused, so it's more powerful in other areas?
Well, it's contained within the home and in limited ways outside of the home. Does a woman use her sexuality outside of the home? Of course she does. She uses it in every one of her interactions. But it's more contained outside the home than inside the home. It's more contained inside the home than inside the bedroom. It's more contained inside the bedroom than during the time of having sexual relations. There are different levels of containment. And we're simply saying that when you're outside of the home, you are imposing, without even knowing it, you are imposing yourself in a way that isn't necessarily fair on the society around you. Now, why don't men close their eyes so we can deal with that? The reason I said society is because that brings an interaction, that causes the whole dynamic to stop. It's not just you've imposed on a man and he gets into crisis. That sets off a whole society, an industry, and then Hollywood develops and the advertising industry develops around it, and all of this then becomes all an aspect of that. Anybody will tell you that you need a pretty woman not dressed very, very, very sneezily in an advert to make the advert work. What does that say about the power of a woman to influence a man's thinking? How much research does one have to do into the thing to know that people are prepared to spend millions on having the right model with the wrong dress and to get a product sold? What does that tell you about a woman's power and how much that's worth? Now, is it right that those things, those images that advertisers will pay millions for should just be roaming the streets? And what does that do to society and to their value? So there are difficulties, there are problems in it. One cannot not acknowledge, and I think a woman does herself, and women do themselves a great disservice by not acknowledging the impact that they don't realize themselves they have in the way they operate. Now, that impact isn't removed by being sneers. That doesn't mean she ceases to have impact. That merely gives a man a chance to make up his own mind. To notice the beauty and the sensuality of the woman, but not to be completely manipulated into a different way of thinking, which wasn't the intention of the woman or the man. It's just because his mindset changes. And that is the power of women. And to me, one of the biggest tragedies of the whole sneers issue in religious education is that it's not taught with the power of women, it's taught almost with the opposite. The women don't come out, the young girls don't come out from the Beis Yaakov school proud of their sexuality and disturbed, but whatever, with the laws of tzniut. They come out very often come out with a suppressed sense of their own sensuality. That's not what it's about. It's exactly the opposite. The laws of tzniut are not to suppress. The laws of tzniut are to allow freedom of expression in the places where freedom of expression are not destructive, and less freedom of expression where they are destructive.
You know, for so many teachers who have to have some degree of intelligence, it should be obvious that if they don't teach it this way, that they're inviting rebellion, you know, on a certain level, and you know, the lack of honesty about it. How do they think they're going to get away with it on a long-term basis?
I think there are two answers to that question. I think there are an enormous number of teachers who don't even know this. Today I'm talking about, this is the first generation that we have this, but this is the first generation to become a problem. In the pre-war generation, no teacher would not know this. Today I would guarantee that if you did a survey among the people who are teaching in girls' schools, how many have learnt this passage of Ovid Rabinos and know it and understand its implications, if you got 1 in 10, I would be amazed. I would be absolutely amazed. I think there is a problem on the educator level. And assuming they know, either intuitively or because they've learnt it, the whole, and this is part of what we've been talking about over the last several weeks, is that the Jewish Orthodox, I'm talking about extreme Orthodox life, has become increasingly control-based rather than knowledge-based. And that was the argument between the Hasidim and the Vilna Gaon. That was the whole argument. The Vilna Gaon said, use reason. You don't have to get involved in the control stuff. It's all there. You can persuade people through reason and through discussion and debate. That was the whole approach, the whole Lithuanian approach. And the Hasidic approach was, there's a Rebbe, there's a view, and what's happened is the world since the war has edged in entirely into the Hasidic approach, even those who are not Hasidic. So now instead of saying the Rebbe, they say the Gedolim. But they use it interchangeably, exactly as the Hasidim would say the Rebbe, our guys say the Gedolim. But it's exactly the same kind of thing. What is it? It's control. Do this or else. And it's beautiful and it's wonderful, and one day you'll learn all about it.
So are you suggesting that in previous generations this would have been, or this issue would have been taught with more honesty? That you know, if a woman said
it
that...
It was much less of an issue.
So especially it was much less of an issue. It's how women dressed. That was not only Jewish women.
Yeah, but it was
non-Jewish women also dressed like that.
Issue,
it wasn't an issue.
It could be another issue.
Issues were in Lithuania. I'm talking about Lithuania.
This
isn't the only issue that could be a problem, you know. There are other issues that could be a problem. So I'm just asking, would that kind of empathy that you mentioned before, would that have happened more, or do you think that a woman might have been still given that pat answer, you know, not a Sevenishma, you know?
Not in Lithuania. Lithuania, that's the essence. And when we talk about what the tragedy of what we lost in the Second World War, and we lost one lot of wonderful people and civilizations and cities, and we have no concept of what we've lost. And Ruya describes one of the things she saw that had most emotive impression on me, on her, was at one of the places there is a field, it used to be a concentration camp that's got bombed, so there's nothing left there. They put a stone to commemorate each village that was destroyed. And the vastness of this field, and she told me about it and was very impressive. But then she showed me a photograph. You cannot imagine. A stone, a rock for every village. You cannot imagine. Just a vast expanse of tens of thousands of rocks. Each one was a community with a rabbi, with a school, with each one of those. You cannot imagine the vastness of what we lost. But apart from all that vastness, when we look at Lithuania, a little place with a small community. 100,000 Jews in Lithuania, that was all. But what gems, and what gems of assistance.
There were only 100,000?
That's all there was in Lithuania, 100,000
Jews. My grandfather's town had 10,000 in it.
Where
they were all Jews.
It was probably Latvia, where was it?
It was Lithuania.
In Lithuania itself, what was it? Then it was Vilna or Kolka.
I'll have to look it up. But and it was 10,000 in one town.
It might be there were a few big towns, and then there were the little villages. But Lithuania itself is a very small place. Lithuania is a very small part of Eastern Europe. And when we talk about Lithuania from a Jewish point of view, it's part of Poland as well. It goes beyond just Lithuania. Lithuania itself was 100,000 Jews, 110,000. And what we lost over there was not just the number of Jews. What we lost in Lithuania was a way of living, a way of being, a way of teaching, a nobility, an intellectual supremacy, an empathy and a sympathy. Absolutely it was done that way. Absolutely it was done that way. I remember my father telling me when a woman once came to ask Reb Elia, his uncle in London, a shayla, about an egg, whether it was kosher or not. And Reb Elia took out the big Shulchan Aruch and he opened it and he paged and he thought and he went over and he discussed it with her and then he explained it to her and told her. At the end of it my father said to him, "Did you really have to look in the book? Did you know it was such a simple question?" And he said, "I don't want her to think it was a simple question." To her, it was a complicated question, and she had to understand that halacha is complex, and that it was brave of her to ask the question and to have an opportunity to engage me in halachic discussion. Where else does she have that opportunity? To engage a rabbi in halachic discussion. I wanted her to have that experience. That was the Lithuanian tradition. Not, "Oh, it's just a woman, you know, just the art's kosher." Yeah, you know, that wasn't the Lithuanian tradition.
So girls didn't have formal education at that time.
The girls. Then, you're right, didn't have formal education, they had real education.
Mm-hmm.
Every girl grew up in the home of a father and brothers who were Talmidei Chachomim, who used to share their learning at home with the women. The women there were so outstanding that a few of them left school. There's one lady, two or three in Cleveland from the Telz dynasty. You go and see some of those women. There are not many rabbis that know what those women know, with no formal education. What they knew, and it was integrated and balanced and beautiful and normal. They didn't pick it up in a Beis Yaakov school being taught by somebody who'd never learned this. It was a completely different atmosphere. So when we mourn, Tisha B'Av to me is the loss of that, not the loss of 6 million people or the loss of the town. When we mourn the loss of recent tragedies, that's what we're mourning. This beauty, this perception, and how we're now trying to make up for it with nonsense. And the politics and the control and the... just nonsense. Look at what this is. Look at the nobility of what it is. Easy? No, not easy. Difficult? Sure, it's difficult. Is every woman going to do it? No, she's not. It's a difficult choice. Am I going to be judgmental about a woman? No. Do I know what I would do if I was a woman? I'm not sure that I would carry my head. I don't know if I would be able to do it. I'm not in that position. So I'm certainly not going to be judgmental. But just to say to a woman, this is it, and it's wonderful, and it's beautiful, and it's great, and you'll enjoy it one day when you really understand it. That's just not true. It's great as part of a big picture. It's great as part of a society. It's great as part of the history of where it came from. But in terms of what it means for a woman, it's sacrifice. There's a price. She's paying a heavy price for her being part of a Jewish society. Not all women are ready. Not all women should be paying that price yet, or ever. It depends on, you know, if one pays a price according to the assets that one has. Is one's Jewishness sufficiently well-founded that one feels strongly enough about it to be able to pay the price without getting resentful? There are all sorts of issues. That's why Esther said, some rabbis have said to her, and you're not at that point where this is something you should be doing, there are other things that are more important. That's part of the discussion too. But even before we get onto the issue of whether an individual woman chooses to do it or not to do it, what's important is to understand where it comes from, what it is, and how it needs to be taught.
Did you get to the part where how it should be taught?
Well, I've been teaching it. This is how it should be taught. This is how it should be taught. And I'm asking you, does that feel more comfortable or less comfortable than
more?
It's great and beautiful and wonderful, and one day you'll understand it. To me, I would prefer this way, because it leaves me in a position to make a choice with a degree of understanding, not going away thinking, what is with this rabbi? Is he in cuckoo land or isn't he?
Doesn't it also go back to the story of Adam and Chava, in that if she had heard it that way, that first time from him, that reasoning and the logic, that she may have done things differently, doesn't it really go back to that?
It does. I think there were two dynamics in that sense. The one dynamic was his misuse of his power, that he used power instead of intellect to communicate, and her misuse of her sexuality. God gave the two of them enormous gifts. He had sexuality, but his brilliance was his intellect. She had intellect, but her brilliance was her sexuality. And the joining of those two together should have exploded the world. That was his intention. Instead, he used his brilliance to dominate her, and she used her sexuality to get back at him. And that's what we're dealing with. That's where society still is.
And not much has changed.
That's why we're still wearing shekels. But not much has changed.
Some of those things, the thing that's confusing is a lot of the things on that list are things we can do nothing about. So it's confusing.
I'm saying to you again that appreciate a society in which a woman could do nothing about this either. It's only recently the women have choice. It was as compelling 100 years ago to abide by the laws of the city as it is today.
So why is Hashem let it change like that?
The only difference was they were taught what that power of feminine was.
Either they were taught or it was natural in the home. You see, the trouble that
is... Well, no, but natural in the home. What I'm saying is that it was out there. It was. Now it's not out there.
Well, the difficulty now is when a person comes in, one of two things. Either a person comes in from the secular world and becomes religious, so they're aware of the power of sexuality in their secular world. They come into the religious world and the first thing they're taught, because that's the power base, isn't it? Down now it is. So now they don't know how to do it.
You know, out in the secular world, it's out there, the power, but it's not taught. It's very, I want to say fluid, but it's not, it's just rampant. It's like, it's all over the place. So you don't even know what's good or what's bad, and how to use it. That's what's been lost.
I think you're right, but even in the secular world, while the power of it is acknowledged commercially, women haven't, or have lost, or many women have lost, a full understanding of how powerful it is, and therefore how it needs to be used and contained and harnessed and directed. And it's just something enormous that can be very, like any powerful thing, it can be very destructive. And I don't think women have dealt with that yet, that feminine sexuality is potentially destructive.
There are a lot of women who are fully aware and exploit it knowingly and willingly. I mean, I heard a woman on Dennis Prager's show, and the subject, for whatever reason, was women dressing provocatively. And this woman, who sounded otherwise intelligent, said, "I dress provocatively on purpose. I'm married. My husband likes it when we go out, and he sees other men looking at me. And, you know, I just couldn't believe it, you know, that she was saying, yes, I'm proud of this. He likes me to
dress." Let's figure out, what's wrong with that response? What's so bad about it?
Because it's so exploitative.
Of who? her husband likes it.
Of her.
But she's okay with it, and he is, and he's okay with it. So what's wrong with the argument? The reason is to then figure out what's wrong with it. Yeah, what about somebody else's wife sitting in that restaurant?
Yeah, not so bad.
That's all very well that her husband likes it, but does somebody else's wife have to put up with it? Is it fair? You've got a lady who's a little older maybe and not quite as glamorous. She was 10 years ago or 20 years ago, but she's not right now. And now her husband's got to sit and spend the meal looking at the person at the next table instead of at her. Is that fair? So to understand that one, a woman is important, not only a woman, everybody is, but in sexuality it is just so powerful. The moment a woman steps out of her door, she is impacting on society. Mm-hmm. And the question is just how much and how.
Is that why women
and they don't understand that. Women don't understand. The moment you walk out of the door, you're impacting. Now you can work out how to impact. The same as a rabbi has to know, or a religious person has to know. The moment you walk out of that door, you're impacting on society. People are reacting and responding in all sorts of ways. And your choice is just what that impact is going to be. But you can't just live in your own little isolated thing and not realize that you're having impact beyond you. And that is part of the front. So yes, she and her husband, that's fine, that's great, but that's an imposition on other women. Not an imposition on other men. They might enjoy it, but it is an imposition on other women. And that's what's wrong with her.
Right, but based on what you were saying before, it's also an imposition on other men because it's preying on their own natural weakness.
Yes, true, but it's more of the where it becomes unfair, where it becomes destructive, is in its potential to undermine other relationships. In which she has nothing to do with this. So without intent, she is projecting herself into relationships. And I think that's what women don't understand, that they actually penetrate other relationships that they're not even aware exist. They can be standing on a bus and they can be penetrating a relationship between people that they're not even aware of there. That is the power of sexuality.
Can a woman penetrate a relationship if the relationship is good? The relationship between that man and that woman is even so damaged.
Any man likes
it. But say he likes to look at it, but he doesn't.
I think they can because man is naturally not monogamous.
Yeah.
If man was naturally monogamous, that might be so. But man is not naturally monogamous. So for him, a new challenge, a new interest, a new, there's always a danger. There's always something there, and I don't think one can be secure. I think it's much better if the relationship is strong. It's much more resistant. But I don't think society can say, women, you can be as provocative as you want because it's their problem if you can penetrate. I think that they can do a lot about it, but it can't be 100% by any means. There are people who've had good relationships and somebody's impacted on that relationship. And sometimes it's even nobody real. Sometimes it's images. All of a sudden he sees a picture or he sees a movie star, and all of a sudden he looks at his own wife and he just can't relate to it anymore. There have been cases like that too, where there have been good relationships that have stopped. So I think a good relationship is an important reinforcement, but it's not a guarantee. It's a very important. Without a good relationship, what chance do you have? But with a good relationship, you can't sit back and say, this can never happen to us. How many people have used those words? I didn't believe it could ever happen. It can happen, and it happens because society is messing up.
One time, that it was really the man's
mitzvah
for his wife to cover
him
hair.
Yeah,
that too.
The brother's
not
bad.
A man's mitzvah for a wife
that
to cover.
That really was his choice. If he feels it's not important for his wife to cover his hair, he can
veto it.
Or go there.
Veto it. Yeah.
It's not completely absurd. It's not completely wrong because the laws are. We don't have time to go into a lot of the laws of covering hair, but the fact that laws of covering hair apply only to married women and not to unmarried women. Today, it doesn't always used to be like that, implies that the laws of covering hair are part of the laws of marriage, and in fact they are, rather than, they overlap, partially the laws of sinners and partially the laws of marriage, and it's brought as a ground for divorce. A man can say, if my wife isn't willing to cover her hair, I'm not willing to stay married. He can say that, the man can say that, which does imply to an extent that if he says I don't care, then it's not a marital issue, it still is a halakhic issue. But clearly it's not one of these issues that a woman should deal with on her own. It is part of the relationship, and it impacts on the relationship, and that has to be negotiated between the couple, and that's another reason why one cannot be judgmental in a situation like that. It might just not be good for the relationship.
Can he absolve her from doing?
He can forego his right to divorce her for not doing it, from a marital point of view, but there is still a halakhic requirement in place.
But I've been told that, that if it would make your husband uncomfortable, if it would make your husband, you know, if it would make someone uncomfortable, then it's better that you don't.
Each couple, one has to work out where the couple is, why it's making him uncomfortable. Is that the real issue, or are there other issues? One has to understand what the dynamic of the relationship is. It's
but
not the covering hair, it's not the most important.
Didn't he say that it doesn't mind about
it?
Who's sinning that it
should ever? I think it's a question of sin. It's still the requirement of tzniut on her part. There are two parts to this mitzvah. It is a marital law, and it is a law of tzniut. So it has both components to it. I'm not suggesting they call
it. Sounds like a case by case shiloh, then.
All shilohs are case by case. All shilohs are case by case. And this very much more so, because it's one which is not common in society, in the wider society in which we live. So it's a difficult thing. It's an external thing. It's a thing that impacts on relationships. So even more so, it's a case by case. But any halacha that you're going to observe is going to be a case by case shiloh. Okay, I think we need to leave it there.